Mindfulness and meditation move into the mainstream. What can they do for you? If you think of practicing mindfulness and/or meditation as something only Zen Buddhists do, you're wrong. Although these practices do have ancient roots, modern research is showing they have multiple benefits, including stress reduction, lowering the heart rate, improving memory, and some say making practitioners more effective at work. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll focus on mindful awareness, which according to UCLA's Mindful Awareness Research Center, can be defined as paying attention to present moment experiences with openness, curiosity, and a willingness to be with what is, an excellent antidote to the stresses of modern times. So how do you start? How long does it take? And what can you expect if you become mindfully aware? Maine Calling breathes deeply and focuses, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Paul McCartney, Deepak Chopra, Oprah Winfrey, these are just a few celebrities who trumpet the benefits of meditation and living a mindful life. There's even a practice known as mindful meditation and scientific research into the field of mindful awareness. Well, today on the program, we are going to try and demystify all things meditative. With me in the studio, Dr. George Dreher. He's attending psychiatrist with Maine Medical Center. And Nancy Hathaway. She's a mindfulness teacher with the Center for Studying Mindfulness. We invite you to join our conversation. Do you have questions about meditation and mindfulness? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Before I turn to my guest, though, I want to give you a little background about how today's show came together. Years ago, I worked with Dan Harris. Many of you will remember him from his days as anchor and reporter at WCSH and WLBZ-TV here in Maine. He is now an anchor of the weekend edition of Good Morning America and Nightline at ABC News. You might have heard about Dan's on-air panic attack before a nationwide audience. Well, Dan has written a book about how he dealt with that panic attack and a sense that his life was getting out of control. His book is called 10% Happier: How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Really Works, a True Story. He couldn't be on the program today, so I spoke with Dan last week, and I asked him about the stereotype many have about meditation and those who meditate.
The stereotype is that the average meditator is wearing robes, lighting incense, listening to a lot of John Tesh music, and a stereotype that is off-putting to a lot of people. And meditation, the way it's been discussed in this country for too long, leaves too many of us out of the conversation because there's like this perennial pan flute accompaniment. And I think it's time for people who are quote-unquote normal to come out and talk about it, you know, with a little bit of humor, with a little bit of foul language, with some real honesty. And I think that could help a lot of people because meditation isn't just for some people who are capable of quote-unquote shutting off the mind, which, by the way, is not what you're doing. It's for everybody. It wasn't invented just for a special class of people. And there's a reason why you're seeing this elite subculture of very effective, highly successful people doing meditation now. I'm talking about executives from the founders of Twitter to the head of Ford Motor Company, elite athletes, and a fidgety, skeptical news anchor. And I think it's time for people to give this a second look.
So just what is meditation anyway? If you go for a run, and I'm sure you've done this because you run, and you zone out, is that meditation? Or if you get lost in a piece of classical music, is that meditation? Or do you have to be sitting in one place, consciously focusing on your breathing?
So the word meditation is kind of like the word sports in that it can describe a whole range of things. So I'm going to be very specific as when I talk about mindfulness meditation, which is what is being studied in the labs all over the world right now. And it's the type I do, and it's completely secular and has the most scientific validity to it, at least that I'm aware of. So in my view, what meditation is simple brain exercise, and it's got three steps, and I can explain it super quickly. One, sit upright with your spine straight and your eyes closed. Two, notice where do you feel your breathing most prominently? Is it in your belly? Is it in your chest? Is it in your nose? And just try to feel. What does it feel like as it comes in and it goes out? Step three, and this is the most important step, your mind's going to wander a million times to all sorts of crazy things like, what am I going to have for lunch? Do I need a haircut? Why did I say that stupid thing to my boss? Every time that happens, again, which it will a million times, just forgive yourself and return your attention to the breath. This very simple exercise breaks a lifetime of habit of walking around in a fog of memory of the past and anticipation about the future and gets you to focus on what's happening right now. And that act is a bicep curl for your brain.
All right, we'll have more of my interview with Dan in just a few minutes. But first, I want to bring in my guests, Dr. Joe Dreher and Nancy Hathaway. Thank you so much for being here. And a quick aside before we have our conversation, we understand that there may be some weather alerts going on during this program. We will have this online, so you can either podcast it or go to mpbn.net after the program if that happens. I hope it does not happen. But Dan ended that part of the interview by saying, meditation is a bicep curl for the brain. Dr. Dreher, would you say that's an accurate analogy?
Very much so. The brain is actually being rewired by the process of meditation, and any skill the brain has can be improved by some focused task that's somewhat challenging, getting your attention, and repeat it enough. And over time, you can actually change the default mode that your brain functions in to let you be more aware and present.
All right, Nancy Hathaway, we talk about meditation, and most of the conversation with Dan is meditation, but you teach mindfulness. They are interrelated, but not completely. Can you kind of explain the difference?
Well, I've been doing meditation for 40 years, and I started doing mindfulness 20 years ago more intensely and working with Jon Kabat-Zinn. The difference between the two, well, first of all, mindfulness has a certain technique to it, and then there are many different kinds of meditation which have many different kinds of techniques. So it really depends on what kind of meditation we're talking about. From my experience, what I'm interested in all of these years in practicing myself is basically enjoying life, being present in life, and the bigger picture really is the big question of what is this? What is this all about? And not having an idea, but in each moment being really open to the freshness of this moment right here, right now, no matter what's happening.
I want to ask each of you what kind of difference you've seen in patients or clients, a different name for each of you, you've worked with over the years. Joe?
It helps them not what we call catastrophize so much. Some event occurs, and our minds are very prone to proliferate on it and build all kinds of what-ifs, ands, or buts, fears. And by using these techniques, they can back away from that chronically anxious state into a place where they might look at themselves and their lives more objectively. I must say that that can be done in therapy, but that also the practice of this actually has a lot of, we'll say, less than conscious impacts that will change the way you do things without necessarily planning it to be so. So you become somewhat calmer and more focused, and it starts to show up in little ways in your life. So it's not only in a therapeutic setting, but the practice of actual meditation, mindfulness meditation itself, that rewires you over time and makes a change without working towards a very specific goal necessarily.
So people are coming to you because they have great anxiety or depression, or they're not simply seeking more beauty in their life, but they're dealing with very serious problems often.
They can be, although I think anybody, at least anybody that I know, is struggling with their life day to day with things that they wish they weren't so feeling overwhelmed by. And this is just a technique to help you get a better perspective and approach it in a more constructive, skillful way rather than proliferating and going out of control.
And Nancy, what about the people you work with, your clients? What kind of experiences have you seen them and transformations have you seen them have over the years?
So I teach classes, workshops, and then privately one-on-one and work with couples. So last night there was a fun little thing that happened in our second class of the 8-week class, mindfulness-based stress reduction. It was very simple, but after 1 week of the participants doing what we call a body scan and spending 45 or 30 minutes each day going over their body and very carefully in this mindfulness exercise, at the end of 1 week, this one woman said, "This past week was the first time that I've taken a nap in 30 years. So that's a very, you know, taking a nap, big deal. But in terms of 30 years and how we live our life, it's a very simple little indication of this, the powerfulness of this practice. Another woman who was taking a 2-day professional development course at USM had had hip pain for 4 years, and she was due to have hip surgery. And in the middle of the first day, she said, "This is the first time I haven't had hip pain in 4 years.
I think of the old expression, mind over matter.
Yeah, yeah. So being present. So it's about being present and not getting caught up in our thinking, in our judgments, in our opinions, that heavy weight that we carry around with us. And because we're human, we all have that. But the practice of mindfulness is that we are already mindful underneath all of that. So what we're doing is we're studying ourselves, studying what it means to be human, studying this thinking, getting to know it so that when it comes up, we can choose to come back to this moment. And by doing that practice over and over and over again, this woman's, just in a short few hours, her pain went away. It doesn't mean all pain's going to go away. And also, this is what the research is based on. As Dr. Dreher was saying, it's about the practice. So the research that we were talking about is based on people having a consistent practice. That's really key in this.
Because when you say consistent, you mean every day?
I mean trying for every day. Yeah,
you're sort of, yeah, if you can.
Even just a little bit, or maybe it's the direction, having the strong direction of I really want to be more present in my life. And then, yeah, trying for every day, even if it's 10 minutes.
Dr. Dreher.
I think it's important to keep in mind that we're discussing here something would be called a formal practice, sitting down and spending time in a somewhat meditative state. There's also a lot of informal practice. So looking at the way I'm reacting to things during the day and trying to step back for a moment and become more mindful of what I'm doing there and then going ahead. So this is not practice just as we would say in a meditation cushion, but also practice in your daily life. And that's what you want. You want the formal practice to really then guide you into how you use it in your daily life. I'm also reminded of the quote of Annis Nin that we do not see things as they are. We see things as we are. And all this practice is to help us understand of how much we are changes the way the world looks to us and we react to it.
It's interesting. After I read Dan's book, the next morning I went swimming and I found myself thinking about the feeling of the water against my skin, the sound of the bubbles as I breathed, things I have to confess I don't usually do. And that's just from reading a book, not even working with one of you. Is this the sort of thing you're talking about?
It's a nice side benefit at the very least, that you're much more aware of the simple things around you. And there's so much going on in our lives that we just totally miss, that mindfulness will help you see that actually be very soothing, if not maybe in some ways. But just, for instance, being aware of gratitude. What do I have to be grateful for today? Tons of things. And that offsets our culture, which is prone to look at all the disasters and accidents and famine and death. And instead, there's a whole lot of good things out there. And I'm not saying this is, you know, nice, wonderful fluff where all will be happy, happy. But you find a balance in your life that otherwise is lost in a sense of frenetic struggle, always trying to get somewhere and do something instead of being where you are. Another great quote from another teacher was, he was laughing one day. He said, "You Americans are so funny. You always want what you don't have. You'd be a lot happier if you just wanted what you did have."
It's funny. I noticed that Dan's book had hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list, is now at 4. Time magazine did a cover article on mindfulness just a couple months ago. Are you all seeing a big change in the number of people coming to you interested in this, interested in coming at their life from a different perspective today, now, very recently?
Yes, definitely. I came, I'm from Maine originally, but I came back to Maine 10 years ago, and I had been studying, as I was saying, and teaching mindfulness in Cambridge, Mass a lot. And when I came back to Maine, people said, oh, Nancy, you know, you're not going to make it. People aren't really that interested in being present. And then I went to one of the schools, the colleges, and talked, and they said, well, what is this mindfulness thing? So right in Maine, in 10 years, there's been a huge, huge difference. And another large difference nationally is in the education system. There's a lot of mindfulness happening now with teachers in schools, many, many different programs. I was out in Vancouver a year ago at the Dalai Lama Center for Peace and Education and on a mindfulness and education workshop, and there were 400 teachers in the audience. Goldie Hawn has started a program. There's smart schools. There's lots happening in the schools as well as in medicine.
And how would it apply for the schools when you talk about working with teachers? How exactly does that work?
Well, first of all, there's research showing that students who do this, they're more relaxed when they take their tests and the test scores go up. But really what we're talking about with teachers and with, say, parents, I'm very passionate about mindfulness for parents, is that teachers, parents, any caregivers, when they do mindfulness, they're more, if they're in the present moment, then they're more aware and more centered, so that no matter what's happening, the pleasant or the unpleasant, then they can stay centered. So in the classroom, to have a centered teacher, I mean, you know, that's winning for everyone. And also with parents, and also with the amount of discipline that we have in schools and with our children, if parents and our caregivers are being more centered, they can hold their own emotions, because this is very much about emotional intelligence. And if they can hold their own emotions, then they can also hold the emotions of children, their own children, and in the classroom.
Dr. Dreher?
I just extend that slightly. There's a real effort underway also to teach elementary school children mindfulness. And that, in turn, has allowed the classrooms to be less disruptive. And for these children, how learn how to deal with their own emotional states in a more, we'll just say, productive or a calmer or more skillful way. So it's as the teachers model this and the students are taught it, both sides are coming out ahead, if you will.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will have your comments and questions. We'll hear more from Dan Harris, and we'll hear more from our guests. Stay with us. This is
You Make Maine Calling possible, as does Sweetser, serving mental and behavioral health needs of children, adults, and families in Maine since 1828. Sweetser.org.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Carlotta Gall, who covered Afghanistan for over a decade for the New York Times. In her new book, The Wrong Enemy, she writes that Pakistan, not Afghanistan, has been the true enemy in the region. We'll also talk about the risks she's taken and journalists she's worked with who have been injured or killed. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, 1 year after the Boston Marathon bombing, we look at national and local security on the terrorism front now and what we've learned. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Tune in for On Point this evening at 11.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, just what is mindfulness? With me in the studio, Nancy Hathaway. She's a mindfulness teacher with the Center for Studying Mindfulness. And Dr. George Dreher, attending psychiatrist with Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email at talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We will get to the calls. We've got John and Emma lined up in just a minute. But first, we're going to hear a little more from my interview with Dan Harris. I asked him if, now that he's found a sense of calm, whether he worries about losing his edge.
I'm still as much of a striver and a worrier as I always was, but I what I've been able to do is to not make my suffering worse than it needs to be at least 10% of the time. I think if you're trying to be great at anything, whether it's your job, whether it's your parenting or grandparenting or volunteering in your retirement, whatever it is, there's a certain amount of worrying and planning and plotting and stress involved. It's just kind of – it's part of it. And I'm – pro all of that. I think you have to worry to a certain extent in order to be good at what you're doing. Though, you don't have to make it worse than it needs to be. And what I've found is that meditation is very helpful in figuring out when have I crossed the line between constructive anguish, as a term that I like, largely because I invented it, and useless rumination. And so now when I'm pondering all the awful consequences of missing a flight to a story that I'm going to do, I've learned to ask myself on the 17th time that I'm running through all these terrible scenarios in my mind, is this useful? And that is a great corrective to constructive anguish.
What kind of advice would you give someone who's interested in starting?
5 minutes a day. I don't think you need to add this to your stress-inducing to-do list. Everybody, no matter how busy you are, has 5 minutes. And, you know, you can do it right when you wake up, right before you go to bed, when you pull your car into the garage at the end of a long day, right before you go into the house. There are lots of opportunities to do it, even if you have, you know, 23 children and 4 part-time jobs. I think everybody's got 5 minutes, and that will change the relationship between you and the voice in your head, by which I'm not referring to schizophrenia. I'm just talking about that inner narrator that chases you out of bed in the morning and pretty much heckles you all day long and offers you lots of bad suggestions, like, you know, putting your hand in the fridge when you're not hungry, or checking your BlackBerry when your kids are trying to talk to you, or losing your temper when it's strategically unwise. You'll get better at resisting those bad suggestions at least 10% of the time.
Dan, you call meditation and mindfulness the next frontier of human exploration. What do you mean by that?
I stole that from a reporter, a writer who I admire up in Canada. I think that we are heading into a new public health revolution on meditation. In the 1940s, if you had told somebody you were going running, they would say, "Who's chasing you?" Going running was not something most people did until the exercise physiology lab at Harvard proved that it was really good for you. And now running is completely socially acceptable, and exercise is something we do, and if we don't do, we feel guilty about. I think we're heading there now in large part because of the science with meditation. It's going to join the pantheon of no-brainers like brushing your teeth and taking the meds your doctor prescribes to you and eating healthy and all that stuff. And in terms of it being the next frontier of human exploration, we've been exploring all parts of the planet, under the oceans and a little bit of outer space. I do think that inner space is a really interesting thing, that for millennia there's been a small group of people who have been conducting these science experiments. What happens to you if you sit and watch your mind for a consistent period of time over years? And they've mapped out the changes you can create in your mind. And I think that we are going to start to see scientists take this very seriously. And it's already starting to happen. There are people who are looking at what kind of changes happen in your brain if you do a lot of meditation over time. And does that mean enlightenment is real, for example? These are fascinating questions. And I think that there are smart people chasing them down.
All right. Again, part of my interview with Dan Harris. Would you agree that we are at the edge of, Dr. Dreher, on the edge of a lot of scientific discovery about mindfulness and meditation?
The research is certainly exploding exponentially. There's actually a newsletter I get once a month that outlines all the new papers in the prior month. And the average month, it has 50 papers. Some are, basic neuroscience research. Some are dealing with a mental illness. Some are dealing with control of anger. I mean, it's fascinating. So it's being applied in a lot of areas. I think it's important to realize this is only one tool that can be used to help your life be more what you want. But I think it's a very useful tool, and I think we're learning more and more about what it can do. Really, we're learning more and more about what the mind can do if it's given a chance.
Mm. Nancy, what about his idea of just start with 5 minutes a day?
I would say an even simpler idea would be when you're lying in bed before you get out of bed in the morning is to put your hands on your belly and feel your belly rise and fall with your breath. Because going from the bed to even a chair can be a huge job. So starting there and then the 5 minutes out of bed.
Great. So we're going to go to calls now. John in Kennebunkport has been waiting for a while. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have both a comment and a question. I've been a meditator for about 40 years, and I've learned through transcendental meditation. Most people hear of it as TM. And my basic comment is it's been one of the most positive things I ever did in my life. And when I talk to people about it, because people have varying opinions about meditation, they all worry about concentration. And the one word I recall from when I was instructed, I guess you could call it, is that it should be effortless, and it makes it a lot easier. The question I have is, I have a friend who has had a series of back surgeries and recurring pain, and I suggested to him that he try meditation, and he told me that he had tried that several times, but that he was unable to meditate, and either because of concentration or something. I'm not sure what it was, and I was just wondering if your guests could comment on that particular topic.
Nancy, do you hear that from people, that I'm just unable to do this?
Most of the people I see are interested in doing it, so I don't hear that too much, but I know that it's difficult for people. I'd have to know more, a little bit more about this person. And I think that's actually, you know, I can't do it might mean that we have an idea that doing it means we're supposed to be calm. And meditation actually, and mindfulness, the point is not peacefulness or relaxation. The point for meditation is to be present in this moment, and then the side effect is peace and relaxation. So that's important to get that message out, that meditation or mindfulness is about just being here. So when I'm eating an apple, eating the apple. When I'm talking to my child, talking to my child. Rather than when I'm talking to my child and thinking about dinner, or when I'm cooking dinner, thinking about my child. So right now, in this moment, what am I doing? And that can be a form of meditation.
All right. John, thanks so much for your call. Going now to Emma in Portland. Hi, Emma. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I started thinking about meditation at all just a few years ago. My mother has a very rewarding but all-consuming career, and a few years ago she had a heart attack. And fortunately, she recovered and she got the best care, and you know, it was a success story. But one thing I was pleasantly surprised about was that she, in her recovery period, the hospital actually enrolled her in a meditation class that was part of the hospital. And I had never heard about that before. And I was wondering just how common that is to have, you know, sort of mainstream medical professionals prescribing meditation as part of recovery, or even maybe, you know, as part of preventative healthcare to prevent sort of stress-induced health problems like heart attacks.
Dr. Dreher, are your colleagues at Maine Medical Center prescribing meditation?
It's been a part of the what they call cardiac rehabilitation for some years, where somebody after a heart attack is not only physically but emotionally being helped to get back into their lives. It hasn't been labeled as a formal meditation training as much as giving them some skills. As more and more physicians are learning about mindfulness, they're recommending it to their patients more and more. I've had a course I've been running at Maine Med for the last 4 years called Mindful Practice for nurses and physicians to learn about mindfulness and use it in their own daily practice of medicine to help their stress levels. And in turn, I think those folks are then working with patients saying, well, you know, this is available. I might also mention that it's helpful to take some sort of a course that's formally structured to help you learn this. So the mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, is the most common course around. Where it's 8 weeks, and you really, by the time you've gotten through that, been given enough skills to continue working on it on your own, although I still think it's valuable to be working with somebody besides yourself long-term. So it's becoming more mainstream, and I think all the research is beginning to help us understand how to best use it in a mainstream way.
All right. Thanks for your call, Emma. Going to Judith in Belfast. Hi, Judith. Go ahead.
Hi. I love every single thing that everyone has said, and I hope your listeners listen again online. I live in the Mid-Coast. I teach mindfulness-based stress reduction, but what I wanted to share was the focus on leadership excellence in corporations, because many businesses and organizations are practicing mindful leadership, and as George said, it really takes practice. So this is a skill, but the four things that are most important in terms of leadership doing these regular skills are focus, creativity, clarity, and compassion. And that is the major part of leadership excellence. Folks can read more about it by reading Janice Maturano, who is a well-known organization person. And there are schools all over. Google's doing it. Everybody's doing it. We're in the middle of an explosion.
Nancy, would you like to respond to Judith?
Yes, we are in the middle of an explosion, and we have Jon Kabat-Zinn to thank, I believe, for that, bringing it into the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in 1979. If you Google mindfulness in anything, pretty much you'll come up with research or something happening with mindfulness.
It's interesting, the last of her 4 points were compassion, and that's something Dan wrote about in his book, in self-compassion. Mm-hmm. You were both nodding. I'm guessing this is difficult for some people.
Oh, it's difficult for me. And I've been doing it for 40 years, and it's difficult. I feel like just a beginner. And it's hard to even that 5 minutes that Dan was talking about sometimes to get out of bed and to just do 5 minutes. It's hard. Self-compassion is really important to address that because, as we were saying before, mindfulness is about being present. And if we're present, we're going to start seeing the human condition appear right on our cushion. We're going to see our own anger, our own murderer, our own everything. We're going to see the whole shebang of being human. And if we sit there long enough, compassion starts to build up because otherwise we're going to be off the cushion. And when we can start having compassion about our own temper tantrums, then we can start having compassion about other people's temper tantrums.
And Nancy makes a very good point that working in meditation and mindfulness, it's not necessarily or rarely about getting your mind totally quiet. It's really seeing what's there and noticing it and then coming back to, say, your breath, which serves as an anchor. But it's unusual to be able to just sit down and meditate and clear everything out. It's really sort of like sorting out your attic and understanding what stuff you've got up there and what you would like to change or clean out in some way gradually. So sitting with all these things that all of us have running around all the time in our brain is a very important part of the process. I might also add that Americans or Westerners in general are very adverse to being compassionate to themselves. It's one of the interesting things that the Dalai Lama said. It took him years to understand where all of our shame came from. Apparently it's over the top compared to what he was brought up with.
Well, often it's a compliment to say so-and-so is hard on everybody he works with, but boy, is he hard on himself. That's in our culture viewed as a positive often.
Well, yeah, we have a culture of endurance and sort of an Iron Man attitude to everything, which can get a lot of things done, but it also, I think, it destroys a lot of people's inner lives.
Actually, what I've found is that I get more done when I take a half hour to do my mindfulness, and it took me years to really believe that.
Well, we're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Silly's in Portland's East End, open at 11 Tuesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends with vegan and gluten-free options, sillys.com. And Collins Center for the Arts, presenting the Calidor String Quartet performing Beethoven and Schubert, April 27th, collinscenterforthearts.com. And Bangor Savings Bank, serving Maine for 160 years with 56 locations and 700 employees. Bangor Savings Bank, you matter more.
More than just a race, the 2014 Boston Marathon. I am not prepared to trade off the liberties that distinguish us as a country for an absolute permanent lockdown.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick on what's at stake for democracy as we all learn the lessons of the bombing a year ago. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us for The Takeaway this evening at midnight.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Benefits of Meditation and Mindfulness. With me in the studio, Nancy Hathaway, a mindfulness teacher with the Center for Studying Mindfulness, and Dr. George Dreher, attending psychiatrist with Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Nancy, would you like to tell us a little bit of what it might be like to enter into this world?
Yeah, so the wonderful thing about entering into this world is that we're already there. And we're right here, right now. So what we can do is to be aware of this breath that's breathing in us, this breath that we've been breathing since the moment we were born. And we can put our hands on our bellies and feel the belly rise and fall. That's a really easy way to feel the breath breathing. And so feeling that and then feeling the body, like what's under the feet right now? Can you feel the floor under the feet? Can you feel the chair that you're sitting on? So feeling body, feeling breath. And then the senses, noticing taste. Is there any taste, any smell? Touch, what does the air feel like? Sight, right now, what are we seeing? Before I like, I don't like, just what is this perception? And then sound, it's like what is being heard right now? So it's very sensual. Meditation is filled with the senses. And then noticing thoughts that come up and opinions and just noting them and then choosing, okay, do I want to keep thinking or do I want to come back to being right here, right now with what I'm doing? So maybe that's talking to you. Maybe that's cooking. Maybe that's studying. So it's that practice. So right here, right now, in this very moment, while we're on the air, can we take this moment to be present? What are we feeling in the body? What are we hearing? What are we seeing?
I like one of the things you said, which was not to, and I may be paraphrasing this wrong, not to judge what you're seeing, not to decide whether it's good or bad, but just experience it.
Almost, except that because we're human, we do judge. So when we judge, to note that we're judging and then choose to let go of the judging and come back to the space that's before judging. So not judging the judging.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Going to Tim in Round Pond. Hi, Tim. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love the program and listen as often as I can.
Well, thank you.
This topic really touches on the center of my life and some really wonderful transformation and healing. I began taking a class in silent morning meditation at the Chaplaincy Institute in Portland. That's, some people know it as CHIME. And that half hour of just silent meditation following a brief reading was a different way to start my day. And I transferred from gearing up and trying to think, what do I have to do at work today? And just being totally prepared by the time I got to my desk. And by starting my day with silent meditation, it transformed my life. And I did that for 2 years. I've moved on to a more contemplative practice, but I think that it's important to emphasize the importance of doing it as regularly, daily if possible, but as regularly as possible. And there are wonderful resources online. You can get guided meditations, like we just heard a wonderful guided meditation just now. Those kinds of resources are abundant. And Maine, I think, is a great place to do meditation because all I have to do is look out your window and see the beauty of nature.
And Tim, I'm going to ask you and anybody else who's listening and knows about some of these resources to feel free to go onto Maine Calling's Facebook page and post them, because I'm sure people will be looking for resources after this program. So if you do that or know somebody who does that, that'd be terrific. Thank you for calling in. I'd like to go to Shay in Winterport. Hi, Shay. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if maybe some of your speakers could talk about some of the processes that happen in the brain, maybe some of the physiological processes that have been studied associated with long-term meditation.
Dr. Dreher, do you know about, in the very beginning of the program, you said it actually rewires the brain. How so?
There's been dozens of studies. Essentially, they can track the size of particular parts of your brain and show that the part that is attending actually increases in volume, that they're building more neurons there and connecting them to the rest of your brain more effectively. They can show parts of your brain that are linked to awareness can actually be enhanced. One of the interesting ones was the default node network. Essentially, if our mind is not trained otherwise, we're going to fall back into a self-centered way of thinking, which makes sense if you're trying to survive with saber-toothed tigers, etc. But in our complex modern society, that doesn't necessarily work. And meditation has been found to move the wiring, if you will, towards an area that is more focused on the group that you are with and interactions with others. So that's at the MRI level. Neurologically, as far as the chemistry and so on, it's a really complex topic that I probably should get my PhD on, but I didn't. but the brain has a lot of wiring that between neurons, any particular neuron, which is like a telephone wire, connects to another neuron, but then it has branches that connect to dozens and dozens of other neurons, maybe 1,000 to 3,000 connections between each neuron and the neurons around it. And you can actually have those neuron connections. One will be, if you will, be diminished or even taken away, and a new one will be connected elsewhere because of this kind of practice and awareness. So the more we live in a distracted, anxious, fearful way, the more those neurons are going to be rebuilt and reinforced. The more we live in a more, if you will, aware, hopeful, gratified way or gratitude way, the more those will be reinforced. So that's a very simple way to state it.
Thanks, Shay, for your question. Something that strikes me is that a lot of the terminology we're using here, whether it's gratitude, focusing on the present, are also the kinds of terminologies that one might use about prayer. Is there a strong relationship? I know that what we're talking about here is a secular kind of mindfulness and practice, but I'm wondering if there are not similarities that are important.
Well, I was raised as a Catholic, so we did lots of prayer in my early years. And so my relationship to that, to prayer, is that prayer is a wonderful way of being in touch with ourselves and the greater whole, and again, the thinking lessons. So in mindfulness, there is one particular, you might call it prayer, or mantra is used a lot, and that's the mantra of, or the prayer of loving kindness. And people will do this for a whole retreat. I've done it for a week retreat, and This is the mantra, and many people know it. May I be happy. May you be happy. May all beings be happy. May I be safe and free from harm. May you be safe and free from harm. May all beings be safe and free from harm. May I have peace of mind. May you have peace of mind. May all beings have peace of mind. May I have ease of well-being. May you have ease of well-being. And may all beings have ease of well-being. So if we do this, as Dr. Dreher said, the brain does change, and we become more loving and more kind.
We have an email from Ron in York. The conversation so far seems to be directed toward achieving something. He put the word achieving in bold through mindfulness. It suggests that it is goal-directed and instrumental, but isn't mindfulness about being mindful? And I may pronounce this improperly, Thich Nhat Hanh observes.
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Okay, observes that there are two ways to do the dishes, doing the dishes to get the dishes done and doing the dishes to do the dishes. Mindfulness is not about getting the dishes done, but about doing the dishes, isn't it? Go ahead.
Yeah. It's a wonderful point. It's a really important point, and I'm glad that Ron brought this up. Mindfulness is about being in life. It's not about anything else. It's about just being here, no matter what is happening right now. So rather than thinking about life, being in life.
Go ahead.
And I agree with what he's saying. Obviously, the questions here have all been directed at, well, what's the science of it and so on. On a personal level, when I go to a retreat for a week or two or longer, I'm just focusing on trying to be mindful. And what I notice when I come out is, A, I didn't go in with any particular goals, but when I come out like a week or two later, I'll notice I'm doing things a little differently. It wasn't planned. It just arises.
All right. Jane in Ellsworth, go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, this is Jane. Hi to Nancy and Joe. I wanted to just let folks know that mindfulness practice is translatable to all parts of our lives, and I have been for the last 5 years teaching mindfulness-based preparation for childbirth and parenting, and the transformation that comes for couples who are welcoming a new life into their lives is pretty profound. They find new ways of dealing with not just the contractions of labor and birth, but the contractions and expansions of life and the contractions and expansions of parenting. It opens a new way of being for them and for their children. And there's good evidence now to support the fact that not only do our brains change, but we can, in fact, change the expression of genetics for ourselves and for our children. So I just ask both Joe and Nancy if they have more comments on that.
Well, Jane and I taught a childbirth class together, actually up in Ellsworth, the hospital there. And you ask about genetics. Research is not my forte, and there's lots of research showing that it does change. By being aware and being attentive, it changes just about everything.
Mm. Jane, thanks for calling in.
I just mentioned, too, that going back to what we talked about earlier, we all have a vast genetic pool to draw on. And if we are changing the focus of the way we live our lives, then I wouldn't be at all surprised if we might be turning off some genes and turning on others. But I'm not aware of any research about that.
Okay.
But if nothing else, having a mindful parent is going to probably make for a more quiet, calm child.
Thanks, Jane. Going to John in Lincolnville. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking the call. For those of us with attention deficit disorder, mm-hmm. meditation is very challenging because it's not just the monkey mind that we're dealing with, it seems like, but it's like there are many, many monkeys, hundreds of monkeys, and they're jumping from branch to branch and bumping into each other. And so I just wondered if your guests have had experience with working with folks with ADD and meditation and what advice they might have for those of us who have that issue.
Dr. Dreher, you're nodding.
Well, the good news, if you have ADHD, you can have a very rich monkey mind experience while you're meditating. I have a touch of that myself. And so it takes me about 4 days into retreat before my mind seems to settle. What's encouraging to me is that it does settle. And for other people who have ADHD, I think when I'm talking with them, they've had similar experiences. It may make it a little more challenging, but then again, there's nothing wrong or right about the way you do your meditation. So if your mind's jumping around, observe that. Go back to the breath for as long as you are there, and then observe it the next time. And it slowly makes changes, but I know that it's not as easy for folks who have more significant ADHD. And for them, and maybe instead of paying attention to the breath, they can pay attention to the way their mind moves and see if they can catch it as it's just beginning to leave the breath, as the first little ripple of an outside thought comes in. Work on trying to catch that and catch your mind and see if you can delay that wave from taking over.
Well, John, thanks for your call, and that's going to have to be the last one. We are out of time. I know this program could go on for hours and hours. Nancy and Joe, thank you both for joining us. Nancy Hathaway, a mindfulness teacher with the Center for Studying Mindfulness. Dr. George Dreher, attending psychiatrist with Maine Medical Center. And I'd like to thank Dan Harris for speaking with me last week. Dan is an ABC News anchor and author of 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Really Works, a True Story. Today's program was produced by our volunteer Cindy Hahn and by Jonathan Smith. Cindy also answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board, and we had additional help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. And again, if this program was interrupted by any weather alerts, you can go to mpbn.net/Maine Calling or to iTunes and listen to the program again uninterrupted. Tomorrow on the program, what are we learning about detecting and treating Parkinson's disease? Join me and a panel of experts to hear the latest on our understanding of Parkinson's and get answers to your questions. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.